Hello, Christ Community. I'm Howard. I'm the Traditions Pastor here. We meet downstairs in the Fireside Room on Sunday mornings at 9. And I want to extend my greetings to the Traditions crowd and to the folks at LaSalle and to everybody that's watching online. I just want to say, God bless you. And I don't know about you, but Michael started talking about dinner and supper, and suddenly I got this urge to just like go get some food and, you know, have something to eat. But we'll hold off on that for just a little while. I also teach for a couple of colleges. I teach for Multnomah University in Portland, Oregon, and Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, Arizona. So there will be report cards issued later. I expect you to pay attention, and it will be graded. So there are three rules for Bible study, three basic rules: context, context, and context. Words have meaning in sentences. Sentences have meaning in paragraphs. Paragraphs have meaning in wider settings, chapters, and the books in which those words are found. And so for context, I just want to recap a little bit of where we've been for the last couple of weeks. In chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, the resurrection chapter. So on Easter Sunday, Pastor Allen unpacked the absolute evidence-based eyewitness testimony that leads to the clear conclusion that Jesus was resurrected and the profound implications that flow from that for daily living, no matter where we are in our journey, whether we find ourselves in a Peter situation, having denied the Lord when pressed by circumstances, or a James situation who disbelieved his own brother until he was confronted by the resurrection, or a Martha who was so overwhelmed by her hospitality requirements that she kind of missed the main point of an encounter with Jesus, or a Paul who had made a career out of persecuting Christians. And last weekend, Pastor Nate demonstrated the personal significance of the resurrection for each Christian in a theologically rich section of this chapter, and how that reality provides hope for a thriving life irrespective of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. It's easy to thrive when things are going well, but the resurrection of Jesus empowers us to be hopeful when things are not necessarily going well. And so today, we're going to move into most of the remainder of chapter 15, and I have to tell you, it's a bit of a deep dive. I lived in Biloxi, Mississippi with my family when my dad was in the Air Force. We lived right across the street from the beach. It was a busy highway that separated us from the beach. And so my parents regularly said to me, don't cross the busy highway to go to the beach. So one day my friends and I got out to the highway and it looked not really busy. So we crossed the highway and we went to the beach and we're wading around in the water. And it was fine until I stepped in a sinkhole, water over my head. I'm flailing like this. I thought for sure I might drown. The thought that went through my head, though, was Mom and Dad are going to kill me for crossing the highway. This passage that we're going to be in today can feel like we're kind of flailing way over our heads, and we're going to get in there a little deep, I got to tell you, but it's worth it to see the power of Paul's message in this passage. The folks in Corinth were confused, and their confusion led to some misunderstandings and sometimes some errors, sometimes mistakes that Paul takes some time to clear up here, because Paul wants us to see the beauty and depth of Jesus' planned, completed work in us who call ourselves by his name. And he wants us to be responsive to that completed work and particularly responsive in gratitude. Paul's going to help us in this passage see God's ultimate plan for us and encourage us to respond as people of thankfulness and people of gratitude. Now, I've got to tell you, this passage is a little bit more like a 10K run than a 100-yard dash. So we're going to take our time, we're going to take a breath, and we're going to plunge into this thing. I'm going to read the first section to you, and it's a long section, but I'm reading it to you purposefully, the whole thing, this first section, because it's important. Remember those first three rules of Bible study: context, context, context. It's important for us to see the context of what Paul begins to talk about here when he begins to discuss the resurrection body, starting in verse 35. But someone will ask, Paul says, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come? How foolish. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps, of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined it. To each kind of seed, he gives its own body. Not all flesh is the same. People have one kind of flesh, animals have another, birds another, and fish another. There are also heavenly bodies, and there are earthly bodies. But the splendor of the heavenly bodies is one kind, and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the stars another, and star differs from star in splendor. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable. It is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, the last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural, and after that, the spiritual. The first man was of the dust of the earth. The second man is of heaven. And it was the earthly man, and as was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those of heaven. And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so also shall we bear the image of the heavenly man. Breathe. Before we take that deep dive, and as an aside, and there's going to be a couple of asides today, this passage is not talking about the in-between time. The time if we die now and go to be with the Lord in spirit. This passage is talking about the ultimate eternal experience of the resurrected state. Walking the streets of gold with resurrection bodies. Enjoying eternity with our Christian sisters and brothers and loved ones. And sometimes we conflate those two destinations. When I was in the military, in peacetime, we had two kinds of transfers. There was a transfer called temporary duty, or TDY, and there was a transfer called permanent state change of station, or a PCS. Some TDYs were great. Some not so great. Well, this passage here is not the Christian TDY. This is not heaven now when we die. There are lots of conversations about what that's like. But the best thing about that TDY is that Jesus is there. To the thief on the cross, Jesus said, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And that's all I really need to know about that, quite frankly, is that if I die today, I go to be with Jesus, Jesus is there. That's all I really need to know. But in this passage, here in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about the Christian's PCS, the permanent change of station, our move to the place with where our eternal journey with Jesus takes off, our personal resurrection, and forever being with God. And not for nothing, this passage is one of those passages that people sometimes just kind of skip on over, like those endless census counts in the book of Numbers. Or we get so wrapped around the details of some of these passages. Like in the book of Revelation, John talks about the streets of gold and in the New Jerusalem being transparent. Well, what is transparent gold anyway? What does that look like? And we can get really wrapped around that kind of stuff. Way back in the last century, a guy wrote a book, 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Occur in 1988. You can get those books really cheaply now. And when we do that, we either skip over it or we get wrapped around some details, we miss the main point, and we're going to try not to do that today. We're going to try to get the big picture from this passage, the big ideas, and we're going to try and let that big picture idea hit home. Whether we've really considered the ideas here or never considered them before. So, meanwhile, back at the passage. We should be reminded that the Corinthians, though they had lots going for them, they were particularly energetic in the pursuit of God's gifts. They also regularly stumbled, both behaviorally and in their understanding of Christian teaching. And Paul speaks to one of those stumbles here. But I have to say that I think we should cut the Corinthians some slack, because they are going to get wrapped around the kind of question that you and I sometimes get wrapped around as well. Here's the question. Are you ready? The question they have is, how does that work? How does that work? Look with me again at verse 35. But someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come? Now, when I was taking flying lessons way back in the Stone Age, one of the first things they teach you about is basic aerodynamics. And a passenger I fly with regularly, whom I love dearly, and who is a really incredibly bright woman, every time we're in an airplane, she says, as we're scooting down the runway, she says, I don't know how this thing takes off. And so every time I go through Bernoulli's principle with her, the principle of lift, the shape of the wing, and what happens when air pressure underneath the wing is more than air pressure over the wing. Every time I do this, I think she thinks that Bernoulli's principle is an Italian restaurant. The Corinthians listened to the idea of their own personal resurrected body, and they said, how does that work? Their only experience with a body of any kind was the same one that you and I have when we walk around with these bodies on a daily basis. And when they ask their question, Paul calls them foolish. But when he uses this word foolish, he's not talking about it in our contemporary understanding, oh, you're just so stupid kind of way when we call somebody a fool or call them foolish. He's using it in the Bible kind of way. And in the Bible, foolishness meant that people were not considering things from God's perspective. Paul wants to encourage us in this passage to look at things from God's perspective. So how does he do that? He explains the idea of the resurrection body with lots of different examples of bodies suited for particular places. They are different from each other because they are designed for their particular environment. Plant bodies were suited for their plant purpose. Look in verses 37 and 38. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. And then animal, fish, bird bodies are suited for their particular environments. Look in verse 39. Not all flesh is the same. People have one kind of flesh. Animals have another, birds another, and fish another. For example, worms, those little slimy, crawly creatures that some people use for bait when they go fishing, worms were designed to dig in the dirt. That is not our primary design focus. Of course, though, there are exceptions that prove the rule. My stepson Matt's first word was not mom or dad, but excavator. And he pronounced it ekavator. And true to form, he's still digging in the dirt in construction and doing really well at it. But Paul's point, each kind of body is particularly suited for the environment he finds itself in. Look up on the screen. This is a picture of a Barbie pink, I did not make this up, Barbie pink sea pig. This little creature lives at the bottom of what's called the Clipperton Zone in the Pacific Ocean. This creature lives at 18,000 feet underneath the water. If it is raised closer to the surface, it disintegrates and falls apart. Now, just for some perspective here, our combat submarines, they test depth at about 3,000 feet. Do you get it? 18,000 feet in a sub, 3,000 feet. This little thing is perfectly designed for the environment that it's found in. So then Paul goes further with his analogies and distinguishes between types of bodies found on the earth and the types of bodies that we see when we gaze into the heavens. Look in verses 40 and 41. There are also heavenly bodies and there are earthly bodies. But the splendor of the heavenly bodies is one kind, and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the stars another, and star differs from star in splendor. The sun is a display of splendor. The moon displays splendor in its own right. The stars light up the night sky with their own kind of splendor, but they're different from each other in makeup, in proximity to us, in the ways that we see them, but they are all uniquely suited for their particular place in the universe, for their own role and their own special campground in the universe. We saw some of that splendor, I hope you did, on Monday, right? There was an eclipse. Here we saw a partial eclipse. Some places in the country, they saw a total eclipse of the sun. I had my eclipse glasses. which completely block out any light. So this room is now completely dark. And I gotta say, you guys look really, really good when it's completely dark. One kind of splendor or another. What's Paul's basic point in this extended first section is in verses 42 through 44. So it will be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Our bodies right now are suited for this earthly existence. Christians' bodies later are remade for the resurrection existence. And there's a kind of set of characteristics in those verses. Did you catch them? Perishable. The statistics on death in these bodies of ours are one out of one. In other words, death right now is batting 1,000 in baseball parlance. Dishonor. Adam and Eve first experienced that dishonor in the garden when they sinned and realized they were naked and they were ashamed. Weakness. We can't do all that we want in this life. And trust me, the capacity for what we can do diminishes with age. Natural. Our current body is a physical, spiritual unit with a focus on navigating this world with an eye toward the next. That's important to note. The source of what we see when we review those first parts of the comparisons in those verses, perishable, dishonor, weakness, natural. Folks, this is the impact of sin. It's a three-letter word that we don't like very much. Now, I'm not talking about just mistakes that we make sometimes. Back when I was a kid, we had this really, really steep hill called South Street in the town that I lived in, and we'd like to go flying down that hill on our bicycles. And so we did this on a regular basis. And of course, Mom and Dad always said, hey, be careful if you're going down South Street. So one day, my friends and I are going down South Street, and one of the guys in front of me decides to go down the street with and do it with no hands. So he's flying down the street. He lifts his hands off the handlebars. I thought, I can beat that. I'm going to go no hands and no feet. So I'm heading down the hill behind him a little ways. I put my feet up on the handlebars. You got the picture in your mind? And then I lifted my hands from the handlebars. And almost as soon as I did that, the bicycle starts this tilt, heading towards the ground. And there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. I hit the ground. I'm scraping my body parts. I'm getting all damaged. The bike is crushed. And the thought that went through my head was, you guessed it, Mom and Dad are going to kill me. So we make mistakes, and some of them are really dumb, like that one. But that's not what Paul's talking about here. He's talking about our personal decisions to sin, to willfully disregard God's dreams for us. And you may not have this trouble, but I know that I do. There are days when I regularly look God in the eye and say, you know what? Not going to do that. Or I look God in the eye kind of sheepishly and say, I'm going to do what you don't want me to do. This, folks, this is the legacy of the first Adam. However, our future resurrected bodies, like Jesus' resurrected body, is completely freed from the effects of sin. The second half of each of those comparisons in verses 42 through 44, they're no longer perishable, but imperishable. We don't have to worry about death's batting average anymore. Death doesn't even get to step up to the plate. No longer dishonored, but glorious. In the resurrected state, we will absolutely revel in the experience of being with Jesus. No longer weak, but powerful. In the resurrected life, if God calls us to do it, we will be empowered to do it. No longer natural, but spiritual. The resurrection body is a spiritual, physical unit fitted for enjoying all the realities of the resurrection life. All the frailties of the body in this age, in this earthly experience, will be done away with. Pick your bodily shortcoming. Whatever it is. Whatever it is. It's going away. And we will have a kind of family resemblance to Jesus in his resurrected body. There's another picture on the screen. Aren't they cute? Our son and grandson take pictures taken when they're about the same age. So you can see the family resemblance, right? They look almost identical, although my son says he had a better jacket. I don't know what that's all about. But the family resemblance we're going to have with Jesus is not a family picture kind of resemblance. We're going to be sharing in the joy of an eternally incorruptible body suited for walking those streets of gold in the New Jerusalem, recognizable as our individual selves, but fitted for this new and perfect environment. Resurrection bodies fitted exactly for the resurrected state. These are not just resurrected corpses, by the way. You remember the story of Lazarus in the book of John, chapter 11, right? Lazarus dies. Jesus gets the word that his friend has died. He waits a few days because in that day and time, you had to be sure that the body was dead. So he waited about 3 days to go down and see the family. He gets there and Mary and Martha start chewing him out because he wasn't there when his friend died and he could have done something if he'd been there. Jesus goes to the tomb, stands outside the tomb, says, "Lazarus, come forth." And Lazarus does, comes hopping out. But Lazarus was just a resuscitated corpse. My brain's kind of weird. Here's another aside. I wonder when it sunk in for Lazarus that he was going to have to do that whole dying thing all over again. But that's not what Paul is talking about here. He's talking about the resurrection body. And this resurrection body is the amazing gift of the last Adam, Jesus. So, Paul, having dealt with, yes, at length, with that kind of how does it work question, he sets up what he wants to see us to see about the realization of our own resurrection. And so in verses 50 through 54, he talks about the final victory, our personal Easter. Verse 50. "I declare to you, brothers and sisters, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed in a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true, death has been swallowed up in victory." Paul's talking to brothers and sisters, people who are believers in Jesus. And you may have a favorite musical instrument, and we are really blessed with great instrumentalists and musicians here. But all of us are going to be particularly partial to that particular trumpet. When we hear that trumpet sound, the signals our transition to the resurrection body and the resurrection with Jesus, because it means, that trumpet sound means that we will personally realize, we will experience the reality that death is truly done. Can you say that with me? Death is truly done. Done. Now that's a good dry run. We're going to try one more time. Ready? Death is truly done. Amen. And if we stay connected to the passage along the way, we can see an essential aspect of our response to this gracious work of God. Our response, verses 55 through 57, "Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." Now, I know that the teaching in this passage can seem way off and be hard to take into consideration as we kind of live out our lives. But bear with me just for another minute or so. Bear with me. Because I'm going to quote this author a couple of times. His name is C.S. Lewis. And the book I'm quoting from is one of his foundational works called Mere Christianity. Listen to what he says. "If you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. Aim at heaven, and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, and you will get neither. Lewis is saying that those who appreciate the magnitude and the impact of the final resurrection are best equipped to engage this world in this time right now. That ultimate victory, that future resurrection reality, for each of us has present day, here and now implications. And here's the one from this passage that jumps right out from this passage. It's thankfulness. Thankfulness. Being people grateful to God enables so much in our lives. It enables a focus on others. It enables generosity. It enables care. It enables compassion. Can you imagine just for a minute how different our lives would be? How different the lives of those around us would be if we were living with a thanks be to God kind of approach to life? Can you imagine? Thanks be to God. You wake up in the morning and it's thanks be to God. You have an interaction with somebody in a store or whatever, and it doesn't go very well, but you're living a thanks be to God kind of approach. Or some wise person does one of those flying, cuts you off in traffic maneuvers. Have you seen those? Or they cross like three lanes because they decided too late they really needed to be over there. People who live with a thanks be to God kind of approach to life, we can navigate that stuff way better. C.S. Lewis, again, in Mere Christianity, said this about believers in Jesus. God will make the feeblest of us into a dazzling, radiant, immortal creature, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love as we cannot now imagine. A bright, stainless mirror, which reflects back to God perfectly his own boundless power and delight and goodness. Dazzling, radiant, immortal, pulsating with energy, joy, wisdom, and love, reflecting God's love perfectly. That's what's coming. That's what's coming. My mom died of lung cancer. It was horrific. I was with her at the end and sat with her, prayed with her, talked to her. She loved Elvis Presley singing hymns. I know other people do too, because he's had like 300 million Spotify downloads this year. And so I was the oldest kid. I am the oldest kid. So I was there helping my dad navigate the stuff. I mean, the postmortem stuff, it's just, you know, whatever. And then I had to get in my car and ride back home. And the radio was on, and it was some country song. The lyric that caught my attention was, "The dog stole the Chevy pickup," or something. I don't remember exactly. And that's when my tears hit. First of incredible sadness, because I really miss my mom. We have one of those photo frames at the house that circulates pictures, and my mom's pictures flashes too. I really miss my mom still. And I'm an old guy. But then the tears transitioned a little bit. They became kind of tears of remembrance. I had the privilege of baptizing my mom. I know, I had hair back then. Mom was a deep believer. We did distant Bible studies together. But in the midst of my tears of sadness and remembrance, the truth in this passage hit home, and they changed to be tears of thankfulness. Anticipatory joy. My mom is going to have a resurrection body. She's going to be dazzling, radiant, immortal. And we're going to hang together singing songs of praise to Jesus. And if she wants to sing those Elvis Presley hymns, I'm okay with that. This is where the truth and power and majesty of the reality of the personal Easter, the resurrection of every believer in Jesus, hits home and makes all the difference, or at least it should. This is not some pipe dream for the future, pie in the sky by and by. This is a bedrock hope for the future that empowers the lived reality for the Christian, the future reality that fuels today's thankfulness. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. I want to invite you to kind of let that sink in for a minute or two. I want to invite you to stand with me if you're able. And I want to invite you to open yourselves up. And we can do that through this kind of bodily posture, opening our arms, opening our hands to the Spirit of God. As we say that age-old prayer, come, Lord Jesus. Come, Lord Jesus. And I don't know, I just sense that maybe some of us are so caught up in the day-to-day mundane that we've taken our eye off the ball, taken our eye off the truth of the reality of what God has in store for us. Dazzling, radiant, immortal, pulsating with energy. And so, in these next moments, prayer team folks will be available to you up front. And if you want to just be bold, step out, see if God might have a particular word for you today. The prayer team folks will come alongside you, they'll put a hand on your shoulder, they'll be there for encouragement, and they may have a word for you, which you can test. But let's be, in the middle of all this, agents of thankfulness as we lift this time in worship to that glorious King Jesus.